Andrew, you've made my day.
Well, all of that jingle bells in Mandarin Chinese. Interesting here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about Christmas in China. We have a very new interesting novella from Sophia Institute Press by Catholic writer Priscilla Smith McCaffrey, Christmas Blossoms, in which she tells the story of an aging Catholic Chinese artist who makes Chinese Christmas ornaments. And it's a very interesting Christmas story and gives insights into the history of Christians in China, and we want to talk about that. Well, Priscilla, welcome to the show.
Well, Andrew, thank you, and you've made my day. That was delightful. I loved it, and I don't. Maybe you picked up on a little reference in my book when the Chinese Catholics want the priests to sing jingle bells in Chinese, and then they all laugh uproariously at the French Canadian accent when they're trying to sing Chinese. And the reason I put that in there was because I've always been amused by that scene in The Christmas Story. You know The Christmas Story. Shepherd,
right.
And at the end of the, and they go to a Chinese restaurant for Christmas, and these very earnest Chinese men sing them, deck the halls for them, and their accent is so funny, and everybody laughs. And I just wanted to turn the tables a little bit, and we all are amused by accents.
Well, interesting. Just starting out here for our listeners out there, tell us a little about your background and how you got interested in China and writing the story.
Well, I would say my background and the story are two pretty completely different things. I don't know missionaries in China except one that I knew in the 1980s. I've always been interested in the church and in the missionary church and in the prospect of evangelizing the whole wide world. And so I've always wondered about, these foreign places that are touched by our central story, the West's central story, which is, I think, the narrative of the Christ child. And so that was always very curious to me. My background, the Great Books program at Thomas Aquinas College. Then I went on to study sacred doctrine with Father John Harden. And Then I worked with Phyllis Schlafly for a while, and so I've always been interested in conservative politics and in serious Catholic living. And so I applied some of my thoughts to the story and tried to bring out something that I thought was important for us all to remember, that Christ is for all cultures, and that the story, the narrative story of or the infancy narrative, is, it touches the hearts of many, many people. And someone reminded me the morning, or someone reminded me that Imus, you know, of Imus in the Morning, says that the only Jesus he likes is the one in the manger. And there's some truth to that. I understand that. That's where Christ is approachable and endearing. And so I wanted to talk about that and develop that idea.
Did you have any particular background with China? I mean, how did you get drawn to dealing with the Christmas story in China?
Well, some years ago, I bought a Christmas ornament for my daughter, and it was a glass bulb, and it was painted inside, and it was beautifully done, and they were stallions, and she liked horses, so that's why I bought it. And it wasn't very expensive, and I thought, after a while of looking at this, you know, somebody pretty talented did this. They had to dip their paintbrush inside a glass ornament and paint backwards and on glass. You have a special, there's a special little tool for that. And so I began to think about this and to wonder what it takes for someone to use their art to do something so, so beautifully. And yet I know they're not getting much money for this. I didn't pay that much money for this ornament. So I thought a little bit more about the craftsmen of China and how some of them use great skill to bring about the decorations that we have, both secular and religious, in the West. And, you know, so many of our things are made in China. So I also think there's an irony there that communist China produces so much of our religious articles. And I mean, I also thought there's some cosmic irony there, because that's how God is is maybe evangelizing in the littlest way, you know, to the Orientals, or to the, you know, to the Great Orient. And for a long time, Christmas was regarded as a decadent holiday of the West, and but after the Cultural Revolution ended in 1976, Christmas became business, and they saw that they could produce a whole lot of things and get money. But my thinking was, how do they make sense of our holiday when they're making baby Jesuses in a manger and camels and stars and Rudolph, and now they're doing red pickup trucks and all sorts of elements combine for the celebration of Christmas. So it intrigued me to think about what sense they make of Christ coming. I think they know that Jesus is at the center of it all. And I think it's probably intriguing to them that our belief is that God became a man. And I think we have them with that story. Beautiful. The rest of Christ's story is much more difficult. But, you know, that's how some people are going to begin to learn about the faith. What do you think?
Just curious, you talk about Christmas ornaments, or Christmas has become big business for China. I mean, how have you noticed that? Have you studied that, or have you simply noticed, like, in the stores you go to that, you know, well, I guess, sorts of things we go to the stores are just made in China?
Oh, yeah. It's just experience. You walk around in Rome, half the rosaries are made in China. So there's, you know, all the things that I pick up, made in China. So I just find that interesting.
That's an interesting aspect in the story that you mentioned, something interesting to think about. I mean, so many things are being made in China that sort of become this workshop of the world, and now, of course, you know, people are worrying about, dependency on China, given that, you know, sort of the dangers of this regime, which you of course, indicate in the book. Have you studied anything or know of anything of what role any such sort of big business of Christmas have had in China? I mean, in this story, you indicate sort of, people are already starting to think about these ornaments. Have you read anything about people in China starting to become interested in Christmas, or is there any? I mean, I know, for example, in Japan, people talk about that. There isn't necessarily much Christian belief in Japan, but apparently, you know, the Japanese, they just really love Christmas as just a fun party, kind of a fun holiday, and they just sort of like to, you know, put up Christmas trees and Santa Claus, but they don't really care about, you know.
The message. Yeah, China has a similar response at this point, because they've developed so many decorations that a lot of the hotels will decorate, and, you know, it'll be really over the top. I had a friend who was there once on a business trip, and he said it was unbelievable how the hotel looked. But this fades in and out in different areas. Sometimes someone says, no, we don't want Christmas decorations, and then sometimes it's okay. That's the way China is. And it's not the same in one place as it is in another. That's the nature of an oppressive regime.
Yeah, I guess I can imagine. You know, I would expect. I've never personally been to China, but I can well imagine that, you know, sort of touristy business areas, you know, big cities like Shanghai or such, maybe Beijing. You know, you probably have in hotels like, you know, big massive Christmas display. But of course, going out in the country. Perhaps the government is much more reserved about that. I mean, you talk in the book about, the government being repressive towards Christianity. What do you know of the history of Christianity in China?
Well, it's a process. I think they have about 12 million Catholics now. They're probably nearing maybe 90 million Christians. So even though that's just a small, you know, a percentage of their very huge population, it's going to make a difference. It's going to make a difference if Xi Jinping and the Communist Party loosens up a little bit on its stranglehold of religious practices. And right now, you know, who's to say what's going to happen? There's just so much turmoil over there this very week that it's sure to affect the celebration of Christmas this year, I'm sure, in some areas. I'm not an expert in China affairs at all. I just read what other people will see, too. And there's not a lot of information that you can get easily about China and the church. And right now, the Catholic Church in China is in a very confusing situation. The Vatican made a deal in 2018, an accord with Beijing, and nobody knows the terms of the accord. Then they renewed it in 2020, and they just recently renewed it in 2022, and it was to, in a sense, share power with Beijing in appointing bishops. The Vatican is not supposed to appoint bishops that are not approved by the CCP and the other way around, but they just recently, the CCP appointed a bishop of a district, and it's not even a diocese. So they did that without the permission of the Vatican. And the basic understanding of the Communist Party is that there can be no power or authority outside of China for any individual. So that's why they have a problem with the Catholic Church. If you regard the Pope as a spiritual leader, well, they can handle that. But if you regard him as someone who has appointing power over authority within the country, then they begin to have a problem with that. So it's confusing because it's confusing. It's not clear, you know, what will happen in any diocese in a given year.
So well, there's, in the book you discuss. Oh, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the book you discuss that, as you indicated, these fresh Canadian priests who come to China. Do you know anything about the history of the missionaries in China, either from the Catholic Church or from the other Protestants? What sort of a missionary work occurred in China? When did sort of the first evangelization of China occur? On what processes did that go through?
Well, it's wonderful because the Jesuits made their effort in the 16th century, and that history is rather beautiful, where you had Matteo Ricci, who's an Italian Jesuit, and he was so brilliant that he learned Mandarin. He went there. He went to China in about 1560-something, and he brought other Jesuits along, and the Chinese were very open to learning and wisdom. They had their own excellent mathematics, their own excellent astronomy, and then they didn't see this as a threat to them, to their culture. So they had a kind of a contest once to see who could predict the movement of the heavens and an eclipse or something, and the Jesuits had the best way of doing astronomy. So they were very impressed by that, and so they welcomed the Jesuits for a while, and then in time it begins to be a threat, and there's always that mix of missionary effort and Western expansion, and sometimes that's good and sometimes not good. So at various times, the emperors would rule against any foreign presence. But by the 20th century, of course, there was, you know, so much. There was, you already had the colonialism in China, and, you know, the French had been there. You had the French Quarter in Beijing, for instance. And they set up their churches and their missionary efforts. And the Marinolers were there. But then with the Communist Revolution, which happened in 1949, there was great turmoil and upset, and that was followed by persecution of Christians, and they got rid of all the missionaries as much as they could. And then with the opening up of China back in the 70s, there was an above ground attempt to do missionary work. And there have been large Protestant denominations have been successful over there too. It's been more difficult for the Catholics because they have a different structure. Protestants don't have a hierarchical structure or an authority over them. And you and I, as Catholics, don't really think about that very much. We're not thinking about structure and authority all the time, but it is nevertheless there. And we know a bishop can't, or a priest can't just go into any diocese he wants and open a church. He has to do that with the permission of the local bishop. So you do have, It's pretty interesting, I think, how many Christians there are. I think a lot of it is too much connected with the prosperity gospel, because they're told, you know, if you believe in Christ and you do these things, then you live life the way you should, then you will prosper. And of course, a lot of that is true, just because if you live a decent life, you will reap the benefits. But that's really too much connected to an unspiritual idea. But there are faithful Christians over there who love our Lord, who would die for our Lord. And, I think we should do what we can to support them, at least think about them and pray for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I guess it brings up an idea. I've heard the idea before of Chinese Christians. The phrase sometimes I've heard is, maybe you've heard this, it's called rice Christians, that there's this idea that on certain periods in Chinese past, certain people would say they would convert to Christ, become Christian, but it was sort of tied to like certain sort of like benefits that Western missionaries brought, you know, certain prosperity, and like if any sort of repression then came, then a lot of times these Christians would turn away. So that this phrase rice Christians arose, that people are saying, oh, you know, I'll just sort of proclaim this faith if it's sort of like good for me, bring some sort of benefits, but you know, if there comes any backlash, I won't stick with it.
Yeah. At the same time, I think there is definitely a real movement of serious people who love Christ, and they're there. And if they were just freed up a little bit, they'd be able to evangelize. I think China needs hope. A lot of them have been raised up from their poverty, and that's Klaus Schwab was even talking about it, but you know, it was through very repressive and oppressive means that the people are where they are today, and a lot of people are satisfied with that. But at the same time, just like materialistic Americans, they're thinking, you know, is this all there is? That I have this job where I can have a decent home and be fed all the time, and that's it. I mean, what else is there to my life? So they have to be asking now. You know, once you get out of poverty, you can begin to ask questions about the meaning of life. When you're in absolute poverty and you're in survival mode, you're not even thinking about what's the meaning. You're not asking the great questions. But now they're at a point where they can ask these questions. And I think that there's a hunger and they're looking. And the reason I think there's a hunger, you know, look at Cardinal Zen and look at Jimmy Lai. And, you know, Jimmy Lai is one of those people who is being prosecuted. He's a billionaire. He could have left Hong Kong. He could have been safe. But he faced a trial, and now he's facing possibly life imprisonment. And I think it's because he wanted to witness to his faith, and he wanted to witness to what he saw as what should be just for the people of China. So you have real heroism over there. I mean, something's unfolding there right now. And I hope it's not going to be crushed. Pardon me?
Well, you also mentioned in the past that sometimes I found it interesting. You said that Christianity was actually sort of there wasn't much resistance to it. It was welcome. I mean, you talk about the great learning of the Jesuits and so forth. And I think of other examples in Asia, like people always point to, like, say, Japan, where the Japanese. There was indeed a crackdown there on Christianity. I guess in the maybe it was in the 1600s. I'm trying to remember where they actually made Christianity legal for a while. But you're saying in China it was welcome. But then you said that sometimes it was deemed as being Western or being attached to foreign powers, and then there would be a certain backlash. How did that happen, or what factors would influence that?
Well, I guess it would be pretty generic. They were smart enough to see that there were threatening powers and that they wouldn't have control over some of these people who would be coming in, presumably to have commerce with them. And so I guess it would depend in the different areas. And I'm just not schooled in this, you know, to give you details. But there was a time when they thought they would do trading with the Portuguese. And then after a while, they said, no, we don't want you on our mainland. You can have, I think it was Macau, you can have one of the islands off China. And they just wanted to keep them at a distance. And partly, you know, I guess, you know, they were good philosophers. They respected learning and wise men. And they must have seen that the message and the philosophy of the West was very different from their own. And it would be a challenge to an emperor to have a religion where you have a different king that you worship.
Well, yeah, indeed. I mean, I guess, and you see the parallel today, of course, with the Communist Party. I guess there's, of course, you know, we'll talk about sort of an implicit challenge that you're no longer giving your full loyalty to the Communist Party, but you believe in God and a different moral authority, different standard, have that thesis. So there's a competition there. I guess in particular of Chinese and Christians in the past in terms of backlash, I guess the great example people point to is the Boxer Rebellion of this group called the Boxers in China. In 1902, mm-hmm. they went around and, you know, attacked all these missionaries and merchants and so forth, and that led then to a foreign intervention force in China going up to Beijing to help put down this rebellion. I know vaguely about that. I'm not also a Chinese expert. Do you know what sort of differences in between Christianity belief system and the religious beliefs of the Chinese? I mean, what sort of religious beliefs do the Chinese have? I guess it's, you know, sort of like a combination of Confucianism, which is, I guess, more of a philosophical system, maybe not so much of a religion, and say Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. I like C.S. Lewis's take on it, and that is that there's a basic understanding, and he referred to it as the Tao, and that's what almost anyone is born with if they think clearly of what is good and what is evil. And so, you know, there are many. Confucianism is a very interesting set of philosophical observations. And you can have a beautiful culture based on that. I don't know exactly what where it would be incompatible with Christianity. I think much of it is compatible. Certainly the communists saw they saw everything from the West as subversive and threatening. And then during the Cultural Revolution, the culture they were revolting against was their own culture. So they were throwing out as much of the old traditions as they could, because they saw these as connected to, you know, imperialist thinking. And now that has passed, and Xi Jinping is now, he will even quote Confucius. They will quote some of the other philosophers that were once canceled. You know, they've had a lot of cancel culture over there. And so now they're kind of going back but rehabilitating these traditions and kind of seeing them through a communist lens. And that's what they're trying to do with Christianity too. Oh, you can be a Christian, but you must also be a supporter of the revolution. And so then you have to, when you look at Christ, you have to look at him the way through the lens of a of, you know, a Maoist ideologue, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that raises issues. You know, thinking of Christianity in the wider part of Asia, do you know of anything? How does Christianity in China and its experience compare and contrast with, say, like, you know, Korea, or for that matter, you know, off of the mainland and Taiwan?
Of course, the Spanish brought Catholicism to the Philippines, and they're pretty, a lot of them are pretty hardcore Catholics. Korea was open to the missionaries, and they have a huge Presbyterian population, and they have a largish Catholic population. So, you know, those things are all good. It fits. Christianity fits with all cultures. And that's, you know, that's what I love. I think that's just so beautiful. And then maybe sometimes you have to tweak things a little bit. You know, for the Chinese, they have great respect for the dead, and they honor their dead, and they had rituals for their dead. And they would probably, sometimes they would venerate their dead, and we might even say adore some of them, but that's, you know, we as Catholics know we have to draw a line. It is very good to remember the dead. It's good to pray to the dead, speak to the dead, ask the dead to intercede for you, and if possible, intercede for them. So I think there's a way we could fulfill that desire for the Chinese to accommodate this their understanding of their responsibility to their parents and their deceased.
I think of the Korean example as well. I believe I've heard statistics that perhaps in coming decades, Korea is going to become majority Christian. So I guess, you know, the Republic of Korea, that, you know, that sticks out in my mm-hmm. mind as sort of a great increase of Christianity. Well, speaking of Christianity in China, you talk about this Chinese tradition of revering the dead. What sort of particular characteristics do you think Christianity has taken on in China? I mean, you talk about Christmas here in China. Have there been any sort of Christmas or Christian celebrations that have started in China? Any sort of, like, are there any sort of particular things that the Chinese do during Christmas or during any other Christian holiday?
Well, that's a good question. I did not see anything. And, you know, you really are limited in what you can access. I try to tune into Christmas celebrations in, you know, through the internet. And they were similar to ours, with the Christmas tree and handing out gifts and singing Christmas carols. And it's all humble. You know, they're not, you're not by and large able to have these huge, big displays of nativity stories and the creche in the in front of City Hall, and we're not able to either, so you can relate. But, you know, if someone said that Christmas was dying in the States because they won't allow mangers on City Hall, in front of the City Hall, you and I might say, well, no, that's not entirely true. You know, it's very much a part of our life. But we do have an ongoing conflict about what we say is a problem for church and state, but that's just a false setup. I haven't noticed anything that is particularly Chinese. You know, maybe they use lanterns more than we do. And Christmas is not far from their own biggest holiday, which is the Chinese New Year. And I think for some people, they see it as kind of a beginning to that season where you're anticipating Chinese New Year. So, you know, they do, some of them do celebrate.
Well, yeah, I would not compare, I guess, you know, as you indicated in the book, you know, any sort of oppression of Chinese communists with, you know, battles over church and state in the United States. I mean, obviously, we're, you know, we should thank our count our blessings that we're not living in China. But, you know, you go into the book to the events of, like, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution in China. I mean, starting with the Great Leap Forward in 1958 and then following on later with the Cultural Revolution of 1966, 1976, and, you know, all this mass death, all of the fanaticism and this forced attempt to industrialize and the famine that broke out. You cite a figure of something like 65 million dead during the period of communist rule. How is Christianity able to survive the communist under such repression?
Well, there were times when they were able to come out and have mass and have parishes and have announcements and have bulletins. And it was clear, you know, what they were doing, and that would be allowed. It just waxed and waned. And but a lot of the church has had to go underground. A lot of the Catholic Church is underground. So we do lose track, really, of how many real Catholics there are, because they can't make themselves known. It's not unlike what went on in the Soviet Union, where sometimes, you know, you'd be able to practice your faith, but it depends on where you were, what time it was, you know, who was in control. Anyway.
Hello?
Yeah.
Just curious. How do you think that, what sort of avenues are there today for Christianity to expand throughout China? You know, people talk about, like, businessmen will sort of, I've heard, like, say, people going over there as businessmen, but they're on the side, you know, they're acting as sort of kind of covert evangelists. What are sort of the key methods of evangelization in China today?
You mean, what are the secret things that they're doing? I can't tell you what the secret things are, but because there's so many things that are that they prosecute. You can't bring Bibles over legally. They manufacture their own Bibles over there, and it's got their own translation, you know, a communist-approved translation of the Bible. So it's but there are people who do go over incognito, and they bring the message, and they try to support them monetarily, but that's, you know, of course, difficult. So it's a struggle. It isn't easy. You can't, you know, it's just not like here. You don't have open evangelization.
Well, for the thing, I guess you brought out of.
Sorry? Hello?
You talk about it in the book in the introduction about China and its one-child policy that was always so noted. But, you know, recently they've relaxed that in past years. You've worked with Phyllis Schlafly, you mentioned, probably covered that before as well. What have been the effects of this one-child policy?
Well, okay, they went from the one-child policy, and they eventually went to the two-child policy. And just last year, right after my book was published, they went to the three-child policy. The reason they went to a three-child policy was because the demographics were proving catastrophic, and they weren't replacing the population. And, in fact, it would be, you know, they were there would be a decrease in the population. And the one-child policy, first of all, is just cruel. It was cruel, and as a result, you know, you had many young couples who would have loved to have had more children, but they were forced not to. It was because forcing of abortions. People who did have babies and couldn't pay the fines had to give up their babies. So that that was very, very cruel. But the propaganda was huge, and people just had a very simple understanding, which was of economics, and that is, well, if you have fewer mouths to feed, then you'll have more money, and having more money will lift you out of poverty. So that was the simple lesson of economics that they had. And many people believed that and then saw that, you know, in their own experience, that seemed to be the truth. And a few years ago, a Chinese woman did a documentary on the one-child policy. And she was very much against it, but not because she thought it was cruel to abort babies, but because people were taken away their own agency in this matter. They weren't allowed to make their own choice. And so it wasn't exactly a pro-life message, but she talked to her mother about it, her Chinese mother, and she said, "Why did you only have one child?" She said, "Well, we were told that was the best thing for all of us." And did you believe that? She said, "Yes, I did." And, you know, it's just, it was an uneducated mass of people, and there were oppressive overlords, and they didn't have a lot of say in it, so they just went along. And then today, I mean, this week, you look at some of the video clips coming out of major cities in China, and they're taking to the streets. They've had it with the lockdowns and with the cruelty of control. They're calling for the end of Xi Jinping and the Communist Party. I don't see how this can end up in any other way than as a Tiananmen Square effort. But, you know, the wall came down in Berlin. So,
well, I guess your book and your story here of Christmas ornaments and the interplay between China and the outside world, it brings up issues. How would you weigh, I mean, many people are discussing this more about sort of the opening of the West to China, or the attempt to sort of try to integrate China in the wider world following its sort of dramatic market opening in 1979, and you had, like, in the 1990s in particular, bringing China to world institutions like the World Trade Organization, this idea of trying to liberalize China through trade. How would you assess that balance? I mean, of course, now people are worried about, China's really grown strong economically, even done things like, you know, steal Western technology and so forth, and so now you have this rising military power. So what are sort of the pros and cons, do you think, of this kind of greater integration, openness with China, and how has that developed China, or might develop China in the future, for better or for worse?
Well, my opinion doesn't count for too much, but I've always thought that trade is a very interesting and, in a sense, innocent activity, that between two countries between among a group of men, trade is a good thing, just generally. But when the money that you put into a state supports a mass of military and an oppressive government, then, you know, you have to think again, is that a good thing to support? What are we going to do for these people over there? I have no idea. That's way too complicated. I just pray that, you know, God will intervene and show people what to do. You know,
it's a complex issue.
Oh yeah.
I mean, oh, yeah. Well, you have the fear of building up China, but then you're talking about Western influence in Christianity. You know, you point to, you know, the growth of the Christian community in China. I mean, that's also been a hope that people have had, that, you know, a growth of Christianity in China can really sort of, you know, transform China. I mean, you would look at, for example, the history of Christianity in the past, that, it was precisely the growth of Christianity that really transformed the Roman Empire, right? I mean, you had this really oppressive empire, but then it became Christianized from within just through sort of evangelization, you know, kind of soft power. So
yeah.
That's the kind of hope that people have with China, but it's a complicated, delicate balance as to what might happen in any particular time period. And, of course, now people are pointing to the rise in military power and the possibility of an attack on Taiwan that's really threatening.
Yeah, I kind of don't think that'll happen, except as a show of power, because they have a good business relationship with Taiwan. You know, it works for them, and it works for Taiwan. That's just a feeling I have. What will they get out of it? That's kind of my question. They have a pretty good situation now with Taiwan.
Right. Well, I guess looking at your story a little bit more, talk to us a little bit more about this character and the story and how you came up with it and what sort of themes you want to bring across.
Well, the story is just the unfolding of the last years of an old man in China who was raised as a Catholic, who knew what Catholicism was about, who knew what Advent and Christmas was about, but when he was 9 years old, he was separated from his family and the priests and the church, and he lived the rest of his life trying to be something of a Catholic, but he had to be careful, and he's a quiet, talented artist. And he's at his best when he's explaining sounds and smells of Advent and Christmas are to his fellow artisans. And sometimes he's brave and can talk about Christianity. And sometimes he talks about it as the great myth of the West so that they can keep it kind of in context. All cultures have their own myths. And the West has its myth or story. And sometimes he would go a little bit more into the story, and when everybody liked the idea of the Christ child, and the stable setting of his birth has become iconic all over the world, very meaningful to people, whether they've articulated it or not. And, you know, for us in the West, it's where you have wise men or kings bowing before a child in a manger. So that's to acknowledge that there is a power beyond worldly authority. So that's a huge message that I think is rather subtle. And when people contemplate the images of the Epiphany and the stable, they're really absorbing some of these lessons. And so back in the workshop, his fellow artisans, I think, absorb some of those lessons and like it. But when he proceeds to talk about what Christ did and how he died, this ignominious death, then they begin not to follow him because it just doesn't sound like a very good myth, a very good story. Why would you follow a God who ends up in dying so dishonorably? And, of course, that's the great mystery of Christianity, and that's what evangelization is all about, is explaining what all that is. And also explaining to people that, yes, of course, God, Christ the man, Jesus, could have stayed on earth and fixed, made everything right, but he didn't want the world to be made right. He wanted people and hearts to be made right. And so that takes a great effort on the part of the individual. So then that's what his job has been in his lifetime. But my character, Jian, when the story opens up, he's an old man and still is around the workshop because he has no one to go home to. And he carries around in his pocket a little replica of the Christ child. And it's a reminder of his family and of Christmas. And when he thinks of Christmas, he thinks of his family. And he knows his parents were very dedicated to the holiness of the Christ child. And that was why, in a sense, he lost his parents, because they wanted to remain dedicated to him and not accept the horrible works of the revolution and the corruption of their own children. But anyway, he goes through the weeks before Christmas. He has tea with an old friend of his who's the supervisor of the ornament floor, and he's able to discuss with his friend what his faith really means. And it's one of the first times he's able to do this, and it moves him so much that he decides he's going to go to midnight mass, and he's resolved to do that and go to confession. And he's always looking at the winds of tolerance, and at that time, and it was acceptable for him to go to the same church that he had gone to with his parents. And I checked this out on the internet that around 2015, that really was about a safe time for someone to go to midnight mass. You know, the church was open, everything was kosher. So I had to leave the year a little bit vague, but it has happened. And so he is so overwhelmed at mass and all the more in love with our Lord Jesus. And then he goes home and he gets an inspiration to paint his last ornament. He doesn't know it's going to be his last. He hasn't painted one in years, but he has this beautiful a vision of what he should paint for one last ornament. And so, anyway, you have to read the book and see the illustration, I think. I think that's key to it.
Yeah, the illustrations are indeed nice. That's a nice story. One of the things you bring up here again is, I guess that I thought about this too, is this idea of, Christ, he's just a common man and he dies such a horrible death. I mean, of course, the Christian story is that he rises in glory. He overcomes death, the great victory, and returns to his position in the throne of heaven, the kingship in heaven. Does that idea in Chinese culture really strike people as
it's difficult? I think it strikes everybody as difficult. I think it strikes everybody as difficult. St. Paul talks about this. If you don't believe in the resurrection, then you don't believe. You're losing the whole message. I think that's difficult for anyone to come to that notion of a bodily resurrection. That's a difficult idea. I think heaven is not as difficult for us to think about, because I think every culture has had some sense of the afterlife. But that Christ rose from the dead and was victorious, that takes some explaining. Okay, was victorious, but we all still die. So what does that mean? Where was the victory? Sin. But a lot of people don't. They're not following that trail. They're not tracking that part of Christ's message. They just look at Jesus as someone who had good things to say and did some miracles. And he said, if you're good, you can go to heaven. And they kind of grasp that. But what they don't understand is that he's trying to make them accountable for their sins so that they can repent and believe through him and to achieve eternal life. So I think the idea of bodily resurrection is quite difficult for people to grasp and believe.
Well, tell us a little bit about, thinking of this story in the context of your other writings. What other story ideas might you have that was looked you've written in the past with your wider work?
What other stories have I? I'm sorry. I didn't get what you said.
Yeah. What other stories are you thinking about writing, or have you written in the past? And how does this particular story here of Christmas in China and of this character fit in with your wider work?
Well, I don't really have a wider work. I'm always interested in my husband and I have been involved in the effort to bring the old mass back. And my husband started the Latin Mass magazine in 1990. And I said to him, all right, you know, Roger, that's, you know, what are you hoping to gain through that? Because it just did not ever occur to me that there would be this nationwide desire for the Latin Mass and availability. But it, you know, over the past 30 years, that in fact has evolved. So I'm always very interested in tradition and how our faith, how we need tradition to have these, to have an abiding sense of the church, an abiding sense of the faith, and an abiding sense of God's presence with us. And then here again, we are, the traditionalists have been challenged once again by Pope Francis. And so we're all trying to make do with that. But, you know, it's still continuing. I know so many young people who love the old mass. They're not, of course, nostalgic because they never had it before. So my husband also has the Traditionalist magazine. So I'll write once in a while for them, but it's like an essay. I do have another Christmas book in mind that I hope will be published sometime. And is it similar to this book? No, not really. I haven't ever written anything on China. This was my little piece, and I enjoyed it because I enjoyed thinking about China. I have for years said a prayer to Cardinal Kung. He wrote a prayer for priests, and Cardinal Kung, if you remember, was 33 years in prison in communist China. And then he was released, and he lived in Stanford, Connecticut, with his nephew. And he died an old man. He died at age 90. But he wrote this beautiful prayer for priests. And I have been saying it for decades. And so I just, you know, I like to think about, you know, all those places in the world that need to be touched by the church.
Yeah, well, interesting you bring up the Latin Mass. I don't know, has there been any Latin Mass in China? I mean, that would be interesting.
Oh, yes. Well, there is. Mm-hmm. There is, but it will be underground. And I did have a communication with a young woman who was, she is from China. She's studying in the States. She is a traditionalist Catholic, which is just amazing. And I asked her about availability of the Latin Mass there. She said it's not very available because many of the priests are not capable of saying the Latin. You know, you have to be schooled. You have to study it. And yet she said, but we don't have hang-ups about the old Mass versus the new Mass. She said that just doesn't even enter into our conversation. In a way, it's political. It has become a political issue in the Western Church. And she said it isn't like that in China. So I thought that was an interesting observation. And I was speaking with Martin Mosbach, who's a German novelist, and he's traveled to China, and he was in Shanghai, and they did go to a Latin mass. It wasn't underground. So they will have them. It's not normal. It's difficult. Everything's difficult. As I've done. But I do think there are people who appreciate tradition. They understand what that is. Are you there? Andrew? Andrew? Hello? Hello?
Oh, sorry. Yes. Well, actually, I think we'll have to end up here. It's been very interesting talking to you for our... Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You were just gone for a minute there.
Oh, yeah. I've got technical difficulty here. Got thrown off right at the end. But I think we'll end up here. Our show's time up here. We've had an hour here. And thank you very much. We've been listening here for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrit, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been listening to Catholic writer Priscilla McCaffrey talking about her new book, Christmas Blossoms, her new novella from Sophia Institute Press about Catholic Chinese artist in China. Well, Priscilla McCaffrey, thank you for joining the show.
Andrew, thank you so much. And if you play that Jingle Bells thing, that'll really send me off with a good feeling.
Oh, well, we got to close out there. But thank you very much. If our listeners out there, tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.